Members, we're going to get started. Today's hearing is a continued discussion of Thursday's MTLE discussion. And we have testimony today from the Board of Teaching and also from the Department of Education. And frankly, members, this testimony probably would have been a better start to our discussion last Thursday, because they'll be able to hopefully help us set a broader context and a little bit of the historical review of this regime of tests. And so that, I think, would have been a better way to start. However, we did have testifiers that traveled far on Thursday, and so we got them in earlier. So it'll be a little bit awkward relative to the flow, but I think it's going to be a good hearing. I would encourage members to get the chair's attention and ask questions as we go through the testimony of the department and the Board of Teaching. And so with that, members, I'm going to wait to move our minutes a little bit later, but I'm going to ask Karen Balmer of the Minnesota Board of Teaching to come forward. Good morning, Ms. Palmer. How are you?
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Palmer, the question, we're going to ask every testifier because we're going to compare notes. How many hours of sleep did you get last night?
Well,
never mind, Ms. Palmer. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Karen Balmer. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Teaching. Had the privilege of being here to listen to your conversation and the testimony provided last Thursday.
Thank you for being here then. My apologies for not getting you in at that time.
Mr. Chair, no apologies needed, because actually what I wanted to communicate is I think that this really is a subject that deserves a good amount of time. So I'm pleased to come back, and this may not be the last time we chat about this either. But at any rate, I did want to provide some basic information, and I hope that you'll receive this information as sort of leveling the understanding playing field, just to make sure that we're all starting from the same place in terms of our understanding around these tests and where they came from and what they are and what they're not. And so I believe you have copies of the PowerPoint presentation in your packet. And so with that, I will just go ahead and begin. Just a couple of quick things, and what I thought I would do is go very quickly through this PowerPoint, and there are links, and so can make sure that you have them electronically, and then you'll be able to access those links and bounce around as your what leisure you might have, but at a later point in time if you want to circle back. We do have in statute a number of requirements in a couple different places dating back many years. Actually, 1985 was the first time the Minnesota legislature enacted language around testing, and that was specific to basic skills in reading, writing, and mathematics. So that requirement has been longstanding. Then in 1998, two additional requirements were enacted, and that was for content knowledge. So every licensure field, that content, for example, agriculture education or physics education or elementary education, has a content knowledge test. And then we also have tests per this law of what we call general pedagogical knowledge. So this test seeks to measure the pedagogy, the broader pedagogical underpinnings of teaching. So, for example, assessment skills, how do we reach diversity of learners and their different learning styles and so forth. So you have here in this slide, and as I mentioned, I'm happy to provide this for you electronically, so you can just buzz out to these links, the places in law where we do have this language. So up until September of 2010, we had long had a series called Praxis. And Praxis is a product of Educational Testing Services, or ETS. And so they offered all of those testing requirements for those tests for us, the basic skills, the content, and the pre-professional skills test, or PPST, which covered the pedagogical skills. So what I want to do here is just provide for you, again, without judgment, I just want to provide for you the information to sort of lay the foundation for all of this discussion. So
Ms. Palmer, and I'm just going to repeat this, so I apologize, but it's sort of how I learned, too, is just kind of repeating back. So sort of the first battery of tests, if you will, are the Praxis series tests. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right.
And those tests, many states actually still use the Praxis series.
Okay.
It's a nationally available testing series.
And Ms. Ballmer, again, what year did that I know you'll get to it, but what year did we switch away from the Praxis to the current?
The new test became operational in September of 2010.
Okay. All right. Let me stop because I'm getting out ahead of you. So.
Yep. Well, feel free. So the pass rates in that Praxis, I laid them out here for you. As I mentioned, they were used by a number of states, so you can see the Minnesota overall pass rates over a period of time was about 92% passing and 88% passing in the reading and writing. Minnesota, there are a couple things that are always at work in these tests. There's you create the test and develop the test at a certain threshold, and then you establish a passing score or performance expectation. And so you can see here in the Praxis series where Minnesota came in relative to other states, just as some context in terms of, for example, the mathematics Praxis test. States that used this test ranged from a cut score or a passing score requirement of 169 to 178, and we came in, our passing score was 171. And so you can see sort of how we lined up perhaps next to other states who used this same test. Now,
and Ms. Ballmer, I'm sorry, so the when we report out, I think this is true in other reports of tests, when we talk about the passing rates, what we're giving is an indication of the first time effort to take the test. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you for that clarification. This would be best attempt.
Okay.
So that what would be represented, and that is that will follow follow with some data I'll share specific to the MTLE later. So this may include, and in fact I'm quite sure does, include test takers that would have taken the test more than once.
All right. Ms. Ballmer, Representative Roger Erickson has a question.
Thank you, Mr.
There
Chair.
He is.
I'm hiding.
I'm still waking up. So,
let me know when we do wake up.
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Ballmer. In 2010, you said this basic pass rate was established. My question is, what was the percentage that you estimated of people that would fail this particular test? If you're establishing a cut score, that's your passing grade, did you have a percentage in mind when this came out that this number of teachers were going to fail this test? Or I'm kind of a little bit confused about the it almost seems like we're establishing the cut score with a percentage of people in mind that are going to fail this test.
Ms. Ballmer and Representative Erickson, very quickly, so this is we're talking about the prior to September 2010, but it's a good question, and it's a question I had years ago when I first started getting into, you know, this area and wrapping my mind around how cut scores are established and et cetera. And so maybe what might be a little helpful, and I'm not peeking ahead here, is for you, Ms. Ballmer, just to share a little bit about how the tests are now. Obviously, we're talking about an old test here, Mr. Erickson. We'll be getting on to the MTLE series here soon in her testimony, but perhaps just backing up a little bit to explain a cut score, how that's set, and what the purpose is of setting a cut score. And in particular, Representative Erickson, it is a little curious about. So we're trying to figure out, you know, whether everyone's going to pass this test or not. So, Representative Erickson.
Well, I'm just curious that you make a test and then you start administering the test and then you start setting a baseline of this passes, this doesn't. I don't know. It seems to me kind of backwards to do it. If you establish the test, that means these must be the skills you want. That must mean that this you want. I don't know. Whatever percentage you would set that up ahead of time instead of take the test, administer it, and then start figuring out how many people didn't pass it. It just seems, I don't know, confusing and backwards to me.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. You'll find that cut scores are used in lots of other areas and tests. Representative Ms. Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, let me see if I can try to address, there are several questions that you're laying on the table, all of which are good and relevant to the discussion here. Let me clarify what's on the screen here for you, and then go back to the question of how the board has historically set cut scores, if I may. So what's here is the performance in terms of the average, for example, the 92% average for basic skills mathematics, that was the performance relative to the cut score that was set by the Board of Teaching at 171. Now, there were times when, and this predates my work with the Board of Teaching, when the board would look at the performance of candidates, of Minnesota candidates, and subsequently make a change in the passing score, this cut score. So in the example of basic skills mathematics, I believe at one point the cut score was actually 170. And after ongoing review, analysis of data, they at one point in time raised it. That's perhaps just clarification about what's here, but let me go back, I think, to what's the fundamental question of how are cut scores set. And I can speak to that most specifically in the MTLE, because that's what I've lived in the last several years, but in the Praxis series, because that was a nationally available testing program, states that adopted the Praxis series would then do their own state-specific analysis of the testing objectives and the perceived rigor of the test and establish a cut score. In Minnesota, they would, I believe, historically look at where other states were coming in terms of setting that cut score, but they would also look at the performance data both outside of Minnesota and within Minnesota. Am I getting any closer to your question?
Well, and Ms. Palmer, we will get closer, obviously, as we move on to the relevant test before us, which is the MTLE. I think, you know, obviously, what you're attempting to do with this slide is to show us how Minnesota candidates were performing under the old test and then trying to do a comparison with that against national averages. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's right. This is just a snapshot in time to show where we were in the Praxis series before that was sunset in 2010.
And Representative Erickson, why don't we hold that thought, because I think it is a relevant question as we continue to get deeper into the next test series. We have a couple of other members, so Representative Verdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Bowman, first of all, I want to commend you for your being so chipper and enthusiastic this morning.
There's a theme here, Ms. Palmer.
And maybe it's just my being less chipper than you, but the 92% average, I don't understand. What is that an average of? How does it compare with the cut score? I don't understand the average.
Ms. Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl. And we'll see if we're all still chipper at the end of this. I think we will be. The average, maybe this is part of what's causing some confusion, is the overtime performance of Minnesota candidates on this test. So over time, and this is about a 10-year window, when we had the basic skills mathematics test, about 92% of our Minnesota candidates achieved a 171 or higher and passed. Okay.
Representative Kreisha and Ms. Palmer, I know we're only like in your second or third slide, but I do think it's important for the members to have a good deep understanding of the issue before us. So Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Chair. As you're going through this, and you don't have to answer it now, and even at the end, if you could provide a distribution of the scores, that would be helpful. To see where they all fall. I understand the cut scores, I understand where you're at, but I'm just looking to see how they distribute out.
Very good. Ms. Palmer, why don't you continue?
Okay. So just a little bit more in our history leading up to our current testing system. We never had the opportunity to really know with clarity what that the rigor or the threshold was for that Praxis series. There were all kinds of allegations and people made comments and assumptions about the Praxis that it's at an eighth grade level. No, it's at a high school graduation level. But until we had the Common Core standards, we really weren't able to do that crosswalk to understand, well, what is the Praxis measuring? What is the rigor and the level, the depth that it's asking of our teacher candidates? So back in 2011, now that we had with the inception of the Common Core standards, actually the NEA and ETS, which is the parent, the company that offers the Praxis series, was able to do an alignment and a crosswalk. And so this is an excerpt, and you'll have the link, so you can go directly to the report itself. I just pulled one excerpt and then made bolded it at the bottom. But what we know now is that all of the content and skills in the three Praxis 1 tests are expected to have been mastered in P-12 education, are covered in all states, P-12 standards, and in the Common Core standards, and therefore cover skills that do not exceed a high school level. So that was really helpful to at least put a mark in terms of helping us to better understand with those Praxis tests, what were they measuring? So now let's get to the MTLE. We, like any state agency, are bound by laws governing contracts, and the contract needed to be let out for bid for public bidding process. We did that, and as a result, that bid went to the Pearson, actually National Evaluation Systems Group is their official title. And so in May of 2009, we did development work after this public bidding process. And there are a lot of bullets on these next couple pages. I'm not going to go deeply into each one, but I think that this one, August of 2009, the board's decision is really important for your discussion in terms of understanding sort of this landscape of these new tests. The board was asked by Pearson, because these were going to be tests developed for Minnesota, what is the threshold? Where do you want these tests to be benchmarked? What level of rigor do we want for these tests? And the board had, in August of 2009, very long, lengthy discussions. Are these tests going to be high school graduation tests? Are they going to be college-ready tests? Are they going to be something beyond that? And after this discussion, it's important to be transparent about this. The direction that the board gave to Pearson was that to develop these basic skills tests at a college experience level. Now, what does that mean? There's no such thing as a sophomore standards or a freshman textbook or a senior textbook. We don't have that in our post-secondary world. So the way that the board put some meat on these bones to for the development work was, he said, our expectation would be that candidates are able to demonstrate skills and knowledge that parallel their ability to read college-level textbooks, write in a manner consistent with basic college expectations, grammar, syntax, structure, spelling, etc., and perform general math skills expected of a college student engaged in a liberal arts education. So that's probably something that you'll want to consider as you think about the impact that's now had on the performance data that we're seeing. So
Ms. Palmer, why don't we stop there? I want members just to sort of brew on that a little bit, because I think this is key. Obviously, we had one regimen of tests. We then did a shift to another one. And I think you laid it out very nicely for us. With the Praxis one, we were using, very broadly speaking, a standard that was, excuse me, tied to a different set of expectations, if you will, as measured by what sort of grade level content knowledge. And then the discussion emerges in the late 2000s, where we start focusing and thinking about college and career, sort of readiness thinking about what should be the result of our K-12 system, and so therefore begging the question about whether or not our instructors are prepared in a way to deliver those college and career readiness outcomes. So stop me if I'm saying anything wrong here. And so therefore then, and you'll get into this here, we then begin to develop a series of or a test approach that has that as sort of the foundational expectation of demonstration of content. I think that probably, and I want to get out a little bit ahead here, probably what will happen with some of the questions, I hope some of the questions that will emerge is might have to do with, in addition to content, assessment of content knowledge, perhaps might have to do with how we assess the one, do we have a variety of ways of assessing that? And two, how does that interplay then with everything else that an instructor, a teacher needs to be able to show competency with? I think that's kind of a little bit of the testimony we heard last week, where apparently we did hear from a candidate who apparently is an outstanding teacher, as judged by, subjectively, obviously, by the people he works with, who's an art instructor, who nonetheless is struggling to get through one particular content area of the MTLE test regime, if you will. I think we get the content part of it. I think probably what we're struggling with is what does this mean in terms of how it all comes together. But nonetheless, you're laying out the rationale here is vitally important. Was that decision in 2009? Where did that come from? Did that come from us as a legislature? Was that people at the Board of Teaching who just said, "Hey, let's just try something else"? Was it the governor? Was it what was the sort of impetus and the the drive, or who were the key decision makers that initiated that effort?
Mr. Chair, that the Board of Teaching set that direction, and so under and we can, go back and revisit history about their authority to do so. The statutes that I had in one of my earliest slides does mandate the Board of Teaching to oversee this program, to adopt these tests and oversee them. And so as we went through that public bidding process, needed to begin the development work to get that those tests operational before the term of the Praxis contract ending, it was the Board of Teaching that took that action and gave that direction.
So, Ms. Balmer, the authority didn't flow from I guess the authority does flow from the legislature insofar as the Board of Teaching is empowered in our statutes to be able to act in an appropriate manner in regards to these standards, I suspect. I don't read the statutes as closely as I should. However, during this period of time, the directive to move in this direction didn't come from the legislature or any other entity. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Bly.
Was there ever discussion or was the question ever asked, is a paper pencil test the best tool to use?
Ms. Balmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bly, thank you for that question. We routinely go back to that question, and I think we are getting closer to being able to articulate perhaps a universe of, and I'll call it assessment, maybe rather than testing, that might get us closer to really having what we, in our world, we call predictive validity, that by passing or succeeding on a certain instrument or measure, it tells us something about that teacher's future effectiveness in the classroom. The body of research on that, unfortunately, has been pretty slim until now. We do have some things, and I hope we get a chance to talk about it, that I think where we're getting closer, and the research is pushing us closer to some data that we can lay on the table to say, we think there might be some new ways to think about how we do all of this.
Representative Isaacson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As someone who's new to the process and just learning how this works, I have to ask a contextual question about do we have any type of directives or documentation or something that tells me why the Board of Teacher felt like we needed to move from the system that we had already to something different? I know that they have the power to do so, and so my question has been partially answered, but I'm just wondering what was the motivation or what was the impetus that brought about the idea that, you know what, the Praxis isn't working, we need to try something else because this isn't effective.
Ms. Palmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Isaacson, actually the impetus for the change really was of a practical nature as it began because of the contract and needing to let this out for a public bidding process and then having to you know, meet deadlines in terms of an old contract and a new contract. I would, and I'm glad for the opportunity to revisit this because I will note that the prior Education Commissioner Segrin actually was involved in this. So she was, and some of her cabinet members as well, Assistant Commissioner Klinzing was involved in some of the discussions at that time. So that would have been, that's probably the one connection that we had to the legislative branch or, you know, or back through the governor's office. So the, and I'm sorry, Representative Isaacson, I don't think I'm.
Isaacson, yeah.
Did I get to your question?
No. You're close, but I have a follow-up, if that's okay.
Representative Isaacson.
What I think I heard you say, and just help me if I'm not right because I'm a little groggy this morning, is that the reason this change came about was because there was a new contract up and we needed to rebid it. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Ms. Palmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Isaacson, on the logistical side, that's why the timing happened the way it did, but
right.
In terms of the substance of your question, you know, why the change to college experienced?
Yes.
I think the board really was looking in earnest at that time at the options before them in terms of, well, what is a reasonable expectation for teacher candidates heading into our classrooms? And so that was their discussion. And as I mentioned, some of the things they debated at the time was high school graduation level, college ready, college experience.
Representative Isaacson.
I think it's always good to be questioning and understand and moving forward. My question, though, is, was there something indicating that the previous system wasn't working? I mean, I hear a lot of things about they had the authority to do that, and I think that's good. I'm glad there's I don't have to do that. That's nice. And I think that there's definitely some processes that, you know, they're looking at making better. But I'm wondering, there's got to be a reason. We don't just fix things that aren't broken, right? And so was something broken? Was there some indication that the teachers weren't rising to a level? Was there something about the tests that we were using prior that wasn't working? What was the reason we decided to do this?
Ms. Palmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Isaacson, yeah, I think there was nationally a discourse around teacher preparation at that time, in our own state, a discourse at that time that suggested that
I have a follow-up.
Teacher preparation wasn't rigorous. Now, this is one piece, and I'm not going to suggest that I think that those were all true statements,
right,
or fair statements. But, for example, there are national reports that come out annually, National Council of Teacher Quality, Ed Week, and so forth. And routinely, this is a topic that they rate us very poorly because of an assumption that the bar was set very low, that this was, you know, that there was no rigor in this, it was meaningless. You know, that's some of the discourse around at least the Praxis series as a nationally available test that, or testing series that was used, that, and it continues to be used by many states.
So let me just make sure I'm understanding this. There wasn't, and I'm not mean to put you on the spot, right, and I don't want you to feel like you have to editorialize for decisions that were in the past. I'm just trying to get a grasp of this. There was a national discourse that sounds like anecdotally there was some questions about whether or not we should be doing something different. There was discussion in how things work, but I'm not hearing you say there was data that drove us to believe that our teachers were inadequate, that drove us to believe that our teachers weren't doing their job. It doesn't sound like there was data that said, you know what, we have to make a systemic change because things are broken, right? And I think that what concerns me about that, frankly, is that it sounds to me like it was driven nationally outside of our state when our state continually ranks very high in education. And I'm concerned that we engage in a system that is now clearly blocking some teachers out and not giving the opportunity for them, or might not give the opportunity for them, when we didn't really have a system that was broken in the first place. At least that's what I feel like I'm hearing. And again, I'm new, so if there is data out there, I would really like to see it. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I mean, to the extent that what you're willing to comment, can you provide me with some sort of data-driven anything that would tell me that, you know what, the system we had with Praxis, it just wasn't getting it done. And so we had to try something else other than national conversations or apparently being a part of ridicule for using this test, which sounds like up until that point wasn't having a problem to begin with.
Ms. Baum,
am I right?
Mr.
So
Chair.
The question going to whether we had data at the time that could objectively quantify for us the need to make a major change in regards to this licensing test.
Mr. Chair and Representative Isaacson, I'll be as frank with you as I can be. There wasn't a body of data, as I mentioned in response to Representative Bly's question as well, that said a teacher performing at this rate equals an effective teacher or not.
Mm-hmm.
That data was not there. So it was a different discussion around assumptions, and we didn't have the benefit of, at that time, the 2011 report that I made reference to earlier. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of generalizing and hypothesizing that, boy, these are kind of low bar tests, and don't we want more for teachers? And that was more of the discussion rather than a hard set of data in terms of the predictive validity that I mentioned before, and that's as transparent as I can be for you.
I think it's very honest and helpful, Ms. Baumer. Let me ask, I'm going to call on our lead because she wants to weigh in on this, and I always try to do a deference to our lead on when we hit on sort of these big issues. But the question then, and it doesn't need to be answered now, can continue as we have the discussion, is what is the current dominant motivating guide for the Board of Teaching relative to these questions? And what is the methodology by which the Board of Teaching will make either adjustments, if they're going to be made, to the current test, or decide to hang on to them? Are we in a data-centered environment where we're culling information out in the field and trying to then have decisions based on analysis of that data? And I will add that, in my opinion, this is a difficult issue for Minnesota to wrestle with for a number of reasons. And one is that while it's certainly true that our state performs very well compared to other states and, frankly, compared to other nations, when we slice out certain socioeconomic, quite frankly, the dominant demographic socioeconomic group in the state, arguably the inverse is true in our state when we slice out information relative to low-income kids, kids of color, perhaps geographically isolated kids in our state. And so I can certainly see where we wrestle with that here as well, where policymakers are looking at, sort of two outcomes that are happening here. But I think Representative Isaacson's question really gets us to a really important point, both for the Board of Teaching and also for the legislature here, which is what is the role of objective data collection and analysis, in other words, looking at outcomes, Representative Marquardt, to guide any decisions that we have going forward. So I just let you think about that, but I do want you to, at some point, give us an answer on what is the dominant, if you can share, what is the dominant thinking of the Board of Teaching, because we're talking about a board here, relative to this question. Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Isaacson. I served on the Board of Teaching from 1991 until I was elected in a special election in 1998. And as we looked at the basic skills tests, ETS prepared, mm-hmm. the Praxis, we had discussions about whether or not this was raising the level of our teachers' mm-hmm. preparation as they prepared to go into the classroom. And our discussion centered around this seems to be more of a high school, probably middle school, high school, well, junior high then, level of testing. And is this the knowledge that we want our teachers to have in reading, mathematics, and language arts as they embark on their careers? So those discussions went on between 92 and 97. We were following the mandate of the legislature passed in 1985 to provide this basic skills test. But then I think because of the discussions we had, and I was one of those who came over here and lobbied education committee members, probably Representative Mariani included, to approve our model legislation for the 1998 requirement that you will notice was adding the content and pedagogy. So, you know, the board, which consists primarily of educators, I was selected as a teacher, but I served with MACT reps and superintendents and other teachers, and then community at large, usually school board members, because the makeup of the board is such. And we had these discussions, and we were changing licensure at the same time. We were doing a major overhaul of some licensure areas. So ours was a genuine concern for raising the level of teacher knowledge as they prepared to teach our students.
Representative Mariani, can I follow up with that?
Representative Isaacson, really quickly, and then members, here's what I want to do. I'm going to have Ms. Ballmer continue through the rest of her testimony. I do have questions from a couple of members listed. I do want to hear from the department. And I think that would be kind of a good point at which we can then bandy around a number of other questions with both the Board of Teaching and the department.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. First of all, I commend the work you did, especially around content and pedagogy. I think that was an important area, Representative Erickson, that we should definitely be looking at. And I'm not in any way meaning to impugn the way in which we proceeded in understanding how we could make this a better system. I think that what I'm struggling with from a system side is the following. We had a sense that something was wrong, and we made assumptions on how, that word has been used a few times now, assumptions of things we thought may not be so good, and we decided to make some changes based on that. And then when we made those changes, we did it without using data to drive how we should make those decisions better in the future, and now we end up with the system we have, which I think is ineffective in many capacities. And so my concern isn't that necessarily we weren't all earnest in trying to make a better system. My concern is that we went forward without making good decisions based on data that tells us how we should be proceeding. Making a test now that I think has been ineffective and possibly excluding some folks that shouldn't be. As well as, I know you had mentioned, Representative Erickson, the idea that it was junior high and high school, but I read on the slide there, it said clearly mastery of high school skills. So if the test wasn't doing that, then there is a problem if that's the case. But if that's not the case and the test was testing mastery of skills, of high school skills, and now we're looking at the way the teachers were actually getting their jobs done, and functionally there just isn't any data anywhere saying that they wouldn't. I have a real problem with the way in which this was proceeded then. And I wasn't here, and I wasn't a part of the discussions, and I get that I'm new, so I'm kind of walking in halfway through the stream. But just from the outsider's point of view, trying to be somewhat objective, I can't imagine why we thought that would be a good idea as a way to proceed. You know, and I'm not meaning to take any, I really appreciate you taking my questions. It's been super helpful. So thank you very much. But I'm going to have to definitely legislatively revisit the way this is being done. So thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. Sorry to take up so much time.
And members, I certainly was here over the last couple of years. And so to the degree that this legislator engaged in any decisions that weren't data driven, I think it's a lesson for us all, you know, to be very mindful about how it is that we proceed. However, let me just come back to the question about data relative to the current board's thinking and methodology of decision making. Is the board currently reviewing the kind of data that we were inferring here in terms of objectively quantifying as best as possible the effectiveness of teaching based on student outcomes relative to the expectations, the teacher standards that we currently have in play?
Mr. Chair, the Board of Teaching has been, let me just say this first. It's very open to this dialogue and discussion, because they're concerned about the impact, as you are, on our teaching force, and we want to make sure that we're doing things out in the open and doing them well. So I'll offer that. To your specific question about data, right now the data that we have available is performance data relative to the expectation that the board has set. So they not only developed these tests, as I mentioned early on, there are two things always at work. There's a test that exists, and then there's a level of performance expected on that. So they're kind of two things that we're talking about, and they're very much connected. The data that the board has been talking about and reviewing very regularly has been around the performance relative to the expectation that they've set. And the way that we got that to that expectation of performance was by inviting and engaging Minnesota educators, and by Minnesota educators specifically Minnesota teachers, as well as Minnesota faculty members in our teacher preparation programs, who helped us once the board had set this direction. Then through what you see on the screen and then the following screen, and I may be getting a little away from your question here, was that they were the ones who said, okay, now, how do we establish test frameworks and the bias review and these advisory committees that came together to do the work of establishing test objectives and fleshing those out into descriptive statements, and I've got some of those links here for you, and then the item banks. There's the test development. And then there was another group of Minnesota educators that came together to go through that item, the item bank, and make judgments about what was appropriate for performance for an entry level, a beginning teacher on these tests. So there are a couple different things at work here. There's test development, and then that set a course for, and then there was the expectation of performance relative to that expectation. So back to your specific question, the data that we really have, honestly, is the performance data. There is a small body of research out there that links success on a basic skills test, not the MTLE, but Praxis, to success on a content test. There's a small body of research there. But that hasn't been a driving force in this conversation.
And Ms. Baldwin, when you say performance data, you're talking about performance on the test itself. Is that right? Right.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, members, I'm going to ask Ms. Baldwin to just quickly go through the slides without further interruption. I do want to throw out a dangerous thought for you all, though, and that is that this discussion about data and outcomes, centered discussion also gets us into lots of other big areas here, including the discussions that we had in the last few years, Representative Erickson, around teacher evaluation systems and frames. And I've been around here a long time, and I could tell you that if we're going to open a door, then we should open a door and we should have a full discussion about what's in that door. And if this legislature, in my opinion, decides that opening the door means that we're going to have a mature and intelligent conversation about what we do to set up a policy frame to promote, support, and encourage the most effective teachers based on, indeed, performance outcome measures, then we need to be true about that. Otherwise, we're going to continue to play the game that we've been playing all the years that I've been here, where we kind of come close to the edge here, and then we just sort of back off because we're afraid of what the answer might mean when we start factoring in student outcomes directly to the professionals that we trust, that we support, that we license in our state to get us to those outcomes. So that'll be the end of my radical statement for the moment. Ms. Baldwin, if you can just go through the rest of your, and I know there's a lot here, I apologize, but I do want to get to the Department of Ed, and you'll still be in the room as we get back to question and answer. Ms. Baldwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go quickly through these so at least you know what's here, and then we can circle back to whatever you'd like to at a later point. What you have on the next couple slides are just an outline of sketch of what that development process looked like. Again, with the heavy engagement of Minnesota educators to do the work for us, and it consisted of bias review committees and content committees and so forth, all to the end of getting these the actual tests developed. It's one thing to have the overarching statement of, well, this is the direction we'd like to go, and it's a very different thing to actually have a test forms in hand with items. So this just gives you a little sample of what that bias review process included in terms of the kinds of things that those committees attended to. And then it finally it rounds out the process through 2010 that led us through content validation surveys to educators, field testing, the standard setting review panels. Those are the people that do the item by item judgments I mentioned a moment ago, that they look item by item. And for those of you who have a psychometric background, I don't. I've learned a lot. But it's the modified Angoff method for any of you that have participated in that work, was the methodology used for these standard setting panels, where they actually made these item by item judgments through some calculations and formulas that all wraps together across all these educators and led to a recommendation for cut scores that went to the Board of Teaching. And in October 2010, the Board of Teaching adopted passing scores. And in this case, not in every case for the MTLE, but for the basic skills, they did adopt the recommended passing scores from that resulted from those standard setting panels and their work. So what you'll have here, and again, I'll just send it to you electronically so you can be looking around. Basic skills, mathematics, you'll have a link to a couple things, the formulas and constants page, so you can see what is it that they get to have with them when they're taking this test. Well, pi, you know, equals 3.414, and et cetera, and here's, you know, the formula for a circumference of a circle, and you can see the formulas and constants page that they have available to them while they're both in advance and while they're taking the test. You'll also have a link to the test objectives. I've laid them out. I've copied them here for you so you can see broadly what the test is covering. I know, because what is college experience? Well, what does that mean? Is it Algebra 1? Is it Algebra 2? Well, the test objectives will get you closer, I think, to getting a sense of what's on there. The link will give you, underneath each of these bullets, there are descriptive statements. So understand numbers in the number system. There are a series of 4 or 5 bullets that flesh that out in greater detail, so you can understand what the concepts are that are tested on that basic skills mathematics. Basic skills reading, there is no formulas and constants page. There are test objectives. You can see them here. And then if you go to the link, again, you'll be able to see each of those test objectives fleshed out in descriptive statements. Basic skills writing, there are a couple things you may want to go to. There is a scoring scale with the performance characteristics for there's a descriptive and an analytic writing sample required. So for those, how are they rated? What is the, it's cohesion and it's syntax, grammar, spelling is one section, and you can see how they are actually scored. The directions for the constructed response portion, I thought, may be of interest to you. And then again, the test objectives. Now, it doesn't quite get to your question last week, Representative Erdahl, of seeing the actual test. I thought we would start here. There are some sample questions online. And then when we know how much more we need to drill down, I'll certainly be happy to provide whatever additional information I can on that. There's a lot of data that I imagine is of great interest to you. This is the broadest information and data that we have. We can disaggregate this. We can slice it and dice it however you'd like. In many ways, we're happy to get that. But I thought I would give for you at least the overarching current performance data. Now, this is, again, back to Chair Mariani's opening question from the Praxis. This is best attempt. So when you see this column here of percent passing, that is not first attempt. And we know that there are candidates in there who have taken it more than once, and in fact, some of them multiple times. But this is best attempt. So it's each candidate is in there one time. And so the number of test takers, percent passing and not. The only other thing I will note on this screen is the note at the bottom. This is a scaled score. So for any test in the MTLE series, you only have to remember one number for passing, and that's 240. A candidate can score as low as 100 and as high as 300, but in any test, the scaled passing score is 240. So that's why the far right column is helpful, I think, where you can see the mean total scaled score. And I don't have the distribution, but that is really interesting data to look at when you can see distributionally how the scores are. But the mean is helpful, I think, in addition to just the passing score. So that information is there for you. I'm happy to provide the distributions in however, whatever manner would be helpful. And then last year, and this slide, I'm sorry, is not in your materials. I added it. But there was legislation last year that impacted the basic skills. In February, the basic skills was, that requirement was changed to make it a requirement for any license being issued. Prior to that time, in Praxis or in MTLE, we were able to issue up to 3 one-year licenses for individuals to pass the test. And that opportunity changed as a result of legislation. And then there was legislation that came subsequently, still last legislative session, to give a little window for us to work through that, where we had a year for people who had been teaching on a limited license, because that happened in February, kind of right before the hiring season and decisions were being made. And the legislature enacted the subsequent law to give this academic year as a bit of a window to give those folks another year to meet that requirement. So that's what happened last year. And now finally, and I won't go in great detail here, but I do want to communicate some of the things that the Board of Teaching has been, as a result of review and analysis, been working on. Some of the things that fall under our authority and we have been working on, for example, where I just this morning came from a room full of physics, earth and space science, and middle-level mathematics educators who are doing this second bullet. They're re-looking at some of these tests that have some troubling performance, and we wanted to convene educators again to take another look at those tests, and they're doing that standard-setting work actually right this moment, and then we'll do some more. We're doing some more fields tomorrow, the world languages. We've added additional time to some of these tests. Basic skills writing is one where we didn't want the time. These are criterion reference tests. They are not intended to be time tests. And so if time is the issue, we're trying to explore, well, and now we're waiting to see how the data turns out for us. Well, will an extra 15 minutes make a difference? Is it a matter that of the testing issue, or that their candidates just don't have enough time to perform? And so those are the kinds of things we've been working on. I can talk more about these. And then there at the bottom, there are a host of things that we've talked about that we don't have the authority to do. And we would love to engage with you around dialogue and thinking about how we might look at these. Some of these really are fixes. Some are more comprehensive and look more like systemic reform. And then some are just looking at real specific identified needs that we've been talking about.
Ms. Palmer, thank you. That's a lot, and I have lots of questions even just in the last slides, but I'm not going to do that. However, I think it is important under the possible legislation part that the board does more than sort of expects and throws out areas to the legislature to look at, but actually be really helpful if the board came forward with some very specific language and requests. And that they would engage and work with members from both sides of the aisle in terms of shaping what might indeed be helpful legislation. No doubt we'll come back to this in a few minutes, but I'm going to ask the Department of Ed to come forward and give us their testimony, and that's Mr. McHenry and, of course, Richard Wasson from the Department of Education. Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Gentlemen, it's 5 to 11. We have 35 minutes, and hopefully we'll have some time for questions. I do have a long list of folks that can do questions or who have questions. I don't know how much Ms. Palmer shared that perhaps might be redundant, and so I leave it to your judgment to try to move quickly over areas that might be strong overlaps and allow you to focus on your key messages today. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Kevin McHenry, Department of Education. Just wanted to say thank you all as a committee for taking an in-depth look at this and taking the time last week and this week. This is a really important issue. We did just want to say, before I turn this over to Richard Wasson, that from the department perspective, we support having the most effective teachers in the classroom, but we want to make sure that we are having the most effective teachers in the classroom and not having maybe items that maybe sound good but don't have the data to support the intentions of the law or of the bill. As we've looked at this issue, as this was passed last session, one of the things that we brought up was there could be some unintended consequences. Ms. Ballmer did cover the steps of what happened last session. One of the ideas that we pointed out was having an appeals process for teacher candidates. After the bill was passed in the beginning of session, we heard from, and Mr. Wasson can expand on this, we heard from thousands of teachers coming from, you know, quality teachers coming from out of the state, teachers that are in the classroom. There were immersion teachers that were impacted by this law. So I think what I'd like to do now is turn this over to Mr. Wasson to kind of go through the basics of this. We'll try to go through quickly, and then we'd like to finish off with some recommendations that we think might be helpful moving forward.
I appreciate that. Mr. Wasson, welcome to the committee. Good to see you.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. And it's really an honor to be here because of my long history of working with this committee and many of you legislators, so I really appreciate this chance. The staff in my unit, Educator Licensing, do our best to apply the rules and laws guiding the teacher testing system in a way that's correct, fair, and humane. My focus today will be to communicate with you some of the experiences the staff and I have had with the implementation of the teacher testing requirements in Minnesota and data that we have gathered. It is not the role of my office to make policy or manage the testing system, but I'm hoping that our experience on the front lines can inform policymakers about what seem like complex issues. In the most respectful way, I'd like to share with you the problems the staff, candidates, schools, and I are experiencing. My intent is not to criticize the need for teacher testing, since I understand and support its purpose, but to provide some information that might improve our system. In a moment, I'd like to first provide you with some of the basic information about the logistics of the system, and some of which you've heard, and I'll go through quickly. I know that others will be able to provide you with much more detail, and it is a very complex system. The concerns I relate are not meant to represent all issues. The issues are complex and will, I believe, need to be studied and resolved. Also, I'd ask long-term that as a state, we consider how our teacher testing system relates to other initiatives to improve teacher effectiveness, like our new teacher evaluation system. Every research and policy report I read suggests that the implementation of a quality system to improve teacher effectiveness requires coordinating new teacher training, induction and mentoring, and teacher professional development and evaluation. So first, I just want to very quickly make sure that folks understand that there are actually three main tests, each with subtests, each with costs to them, to candidates, because I believe the cost issues are something that hasn't come up yet but are very important as part of this discussion. So very quickly, you can see there that the basic skills consists of three subtests. There's a $50 registration fee also required to register for the test. Same for the pedagogy test, except there's two subtests. The content tests have two subtests, except for elementary, who take three. So the total cost to candidates of the required MTLEs are $315, or for elementary, $350. There are additional study materials available from Pearson, and those are also available to candidates for additional cost. So going a little bit into the basic skills issues that we're experiencing. I'm sorry, go back one more. Thank you. You're a little too fast for me. He's too chipper this morning. There are no limit on the number of retakes that a candidate, the number of times a candidate can retake the test, the basic skills test, or one of the subtests. So we found, and Karen mentioned this earlier, that the pass rate for first attempts for the combined basic skills test is only 67%. I think it's important to understand in terms of the interest in data that, therefore, 33% of the candidates are retaking this test. And when we get the calls, we start to realize when we look at the data that this is, since the MTLE basic skills was implemented, approximately 2,000 plus candidates. And many candidates retake these tests several times. Some states, in order to, I think, reduce this sort of panic that candidates go through, have limited candidates to only retaking the test three times. I have candidates calling me retaking the test 5, 10 times and are, I would say, frantic, and I think it's a problem. Thank you. So I want to make clear that the authority to determine and implement the MTLE testing system is under the authority of the Board of Teaching. That includes test selection, score setting, test validation, and the relationship with Pearson. Similar teacher tests from other states are not transferable to Minnesota. You heard the discussion about the praxis. I want to make it clear that for many of our out-of-state candidates, and that's approximately a third of the new licenses we issue every year, where they might have taken a national test that they thought was transferable among states, they are now discovering that, in fact, with very limited exceptions, is not transferable to Minnesota. My office advises candidates on the testing requirements and verifies the test scores only. I want to point out, and you've heard this, that feedback we get is the basic skills, this discrepancy between the implementation that for the basic skills you have to pass it immediately versus you have up to 3 years to attempt the pedagogy and content test has created quite an implementation problem for us and confusion for candidates. So in terms of just providing with some selective data, and we have a lot of data, and we've been surveying districts, and have pretty shortly you will see our new survey for educator supply and demand for Minnesota districts. But for example, in 2012-13, schools terminated approximately 300 or more teachers and in some cases replaced them with less qualified individuals on temporary, limited, or substitute licenses. I can tell you honestly, these are schools and candidates I've talked with each one. We monitor the staffing and licensing for schools every year, and there have been days where I get one or two calls every day about schools, for example, who will say, I hired an out-of-state teacher. We thought we had time for her to take the basic skills test. We're in a rural district. We can find, she's a very highly qualified special ed teacher, but she really does not think, because she graduated college 20 years ago, never took college-level math, that she's going to pass this basic skills math test. So we're going to have to let her go and find somebody on an emergency license. There, I have story after story like that. I need you to know that 27% of all Minnesota school districts reported in our survey that teacher testing requirements were a large barrier to hiring effective teachers. In Region 1, the highest region, 52%, over half the districts reported that this was a large barrier to them hiring effective teachers. Between 2000, this is a very concerning statistic to me, between 2010 and 11, the last data we have for Minnesota graduates of our programs, the number dropped 13%. It's the biggest drop I have ever seen, almost over 500 candidates. For whatever reason, not only because of this issue, the number of individuals going through Minnesota programs is dropping enormously, I think. Thank you. So just to raise a few more issues for you to consider, some of which you've heard, the tests are timed, but do they take into account different learning styles? There's no reason that we know of in terms of test-taking protocol that this has to be time to, in fact, be a valid assessment of the teacher's effectiveness. Arguably, it's really only meant to be for the convenience of the testing company, and that has caused a lot of candidates a problem. The system of, and this is one I hear over and over again, candidates calling me who are saying, I am not able to get accommodations for my testing. And I think the, again, I'm not trying to criticize, but the norms that the testing company has versus what we in Minnesota provide for accommodations seem to be very different. And I think we are losing a large number of individuals who are highly effective candidates or teachers, but simply are not able to get the testing accommodations they need. As you've probably heard, but I want to make really explicit, we expect remediation. There is no system for remediation because there is no way to get feedback on how candidates are performing on these tests. And that's all of the tests, all three sets. Impacts on school hiring, I mentioned that discrepancy between the system where we say you have 1 year for this test, or no grace for the basic skills test, and you have up to 3 years. Schools are getting confused. Now, part of that may over time be alleviated as they start to understand this testing system, but I heard the discussion about the system. I think trying to articulate the system to candidates and schools is a big challenge. We get over 39,000 phone calls a year in my office, 700 to 800 a week. And many of these are from schools and candidates about, now explain to me this testing system and which one I have to take, when and where. I do think we're unintentionally creating this gap where experienced teachers from out of state who might show up at a school's doorstep at the last minute and are really key for hiring simply don't have time to take the basic skills test, and therefore we're missing them in our teacher candidate pool. I have to say it seems to me we're the impact is on kids is that we're losing a significant number of effective teachers, both Minnesota grads and out of state. So generally, I want to suggest that perhaps we consider are the basic skills, excuse the typo there, you look at this and you miss one. Are the basic skills really measuring what we intend them to measure? I know we've already had some, what I think, the discussion about that. All MTLEs are high stakes, but have they been reviewed for fidelity? In other words, the reality is, to some degree, we have never piloted these tests to make sure they are, in fact, measuring what we intend them to. There were reasons they were rolled out rather quickly, so I'm just leave it at that, but I think we need to really understand whether or not, in fact, these are really measuring what we intend them to. And are teacher tests really the best measure of teacher quality or effectiveness? So you've probably heard a little bit about the EdTPA. That's another licensure assessment that will come as part of teacher candidates program. It's going to cost them additional $300 to take this. It's what Karen Ballmer discussed as more an authentic performance assessment, and I agree with and support that. It's a point to consider. I think if you remember last year, there was an article in the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and we heard over and over, I think we're having a devastating effect on the morale of teachers. And this testing issue is one, again, on a personal level, I hear over and over again the personal impact this is on having on candidates, some of whom just do not understand how our system seems to them to be so unfair. And in some cases, I agree with them. In some cases, I don't. But I think there are some unintended consequences there. I think we need to coordinate our systems for teacher development. You heard me talk about that earlier. And last but not least, with the federal waiver and this the reauthorization of NCLB, there's a very important discussion here about how the federal highly qualified requirements can, in fact, be transformed or transitioned in a way that I think will support the more outcome-based measures which we're looking at for teachers. And so there's an opportunity here, believe it or not, to have this be a very prominent part of the discussion. And in fact, what I don't want, because I'm not a political appointee, is to really say we could perhaps remove some of the federal expectations that I think do more harm than good in some cases.
So just in conclusion, after you all heard from testimony last week, you heard from the Board of Teaching and then Mr. Wasson, some of the things from the Department of Education we think might be helpful is with so many questions out there as to the teacher's basic skills test, we thought it might be more important to take a, rather than a patchwork approach of solving this issue, as to take more of a comprehensive approach. Other issues that have been large in the past, what we have done is convene work groups that included stakeholders from across the spectrum and legislators to fully research this issue, not just the basic skills test, but the entire testing spectrum for teachers, to ensure that what we have in place in Minnesota is a proper thing that we need for our students and for our teachers. So what we would do is propose to start this work group and delay implementation of the basic skills test for a year until we get the recommendations from the work group, at which time the legislature can review, consider, and pass hopefully a new solution to this problem. And just in closing, if there are further questions, Richard Wasson is he's handled several questions on these and can provide story upon story of how this has impacted teachers, schools, and students.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate the both the insight of very specific policy issues for us to think about, including our interaction with the federal government, including unintended consequences of our latest actions as a legislature, which we all own. I am reminded that Minnesota is still facing an impending teacher shortage. And we're not talking like way down the line somewhere. And yet, at the same time, we've got some kind of disturbing dynamics, perhaps. You know, less pursuits of in-state teacher prep opportunities in our teacher prep schools. A barrier that exists, perhaps, relative to the MTLE as a final hurdle to licensure, not only for homegrown potential teachers, but also for a growing number, and my understanding is it's a large number, of individuals from out of state with very strong credentials that were not able to take advantage of their desire to be part of our teaching corps in our state. So I sort of feel like there's just sort of this coming together very quickly of a sort of perfect storm of issues here that we simply need to get a hold of. We have a lot of folks that have questions. Representative Solosky, I apologize to you because I skipped over you, so you'll be the first I call on. But, gentlemen, I do want to call, excuse me, quickly, the other folks, because I laid them over from the other committee hearing, Mr. Bartholomew and Ms. Wallstein. If you can come forward, I would ask you to be very quick. And then we also have Mr. Sellers, excuse me, from MNCAN. I'd like to be able to hear a word from you as well. So, excuse me, I apologize, members. So the three of you, 5 minutes, if possible. Many of you will be around for ongoing conversations on this. Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I believe Ms. Wallstein won't be able to join us. She had, I think, the combined misfortune of not only other meetings, but woke up sick today.
That gives us more time then. Yeah. Well, not more time, it gives you more time.
Well, then I've timed this right to 2 minutes. So.
Thank you, Mr. Berth. I appreciate it. And you'll need to state your name for the record, I'm sorry.
Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And we'd ask that you support House File 34, Representative Erickson's bill, as part of an overall strategy to ensure Minnesota has a world-class teaching workforce. By expecting potential teacher candidates to pass basic skills exams in reading, writing, and math as part of their admissions process, we can ensure they are prepared for rigorous coursework and that we don't have people spending 4 years completing a college program only to find out that they can't pass a basic skills exam. As the handout from the National Council on Teacher Quality shows, 24 states, these two columns, currently require college students to pass basic skills exams to enter a teacher preparation program. Only 9 states don't have this requirement of prospective teachers. It's also important to remember that the new basic skills exams were set at a college experienced level. And as Ms. Ballmer mentioned, this means students can read college level texts, have general college level writing skills, and don't need remedial math coursework. In addition, the passing scores for these tests are the ones that were recommended by the Board of Teaching's advisory panels, which were made up exclusively of teachers and post-secondary faculty. The expectations set by the Board of Teaching are appropriate, though as last week's testimony indicated, there should be some accommodations for candidates with disabilities or other limited circumstances, such as immersion teachers from other countries. As an aside, this has been a great discussion the last 2 weeks, or 2 hearings, and a review of the set of exams is good, such as Ms. Ballmer mentioned the board is undertaking. However, in addition to discussing the tests, I think the chair made a great observation that there are broader issues in this area, and that basic skills exams, licensure exams, are just a small piece of a broader issue and list of concerns. With that, though, Minnesota has made solid progress in raising expectations for the skills of future teachers, and House File 34 is an important part of Minnesota's continued success. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. We appreciate the brevity and conciseness. Mr. Sellers, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and committee members. My name is Daniel Sellers, and I serve as Executive Director of MNCAN, which is a network of nearly 5,500 local education reform advocates, and I appreciate the opportunity to briefly testify on this issue. As many of you know, teacher licensure is an issue that I'm very passionate about. MNCAN is concerned with both House File 34 and House File 171. After listening to public and expert testimony on these bills last week, it's clear that the bill authors have identified a problem in our licensure process, and we applaud them for that. However, neither bill strikes the right balance between two key values that our members hold, which are accountability and flexibility for our public schools. I agree with previous testimony that we need more than a patchwork approach. However, I fear that Representative Erickson's House File 34, while offering a high degree of accountability, its inflexibility would likely have the unintended consequence of keeping some talented and diverse candidates from reaching our students and sharing their gifts as teachers. At the same time, Representative Ward's House File 171 is far more flexible, but it fails to hold our teacher preparation programs accountable, and it may have the unintended consequence of allowing unqualified and unprepared teachers into our classrooms. Our proposal is that in the short term, we should require candidates to take the basic skills exam before enrolling in a teacher preparation program. If a candidate fails the exam, allow their entrance into the teacher prep program, but have their exam results serve as a diagnosis of academic areas in need of growth. For the time being, we should continue to require all candidates to pass the skills exam before receiving initial teacher licensure, as this bar of accountability is important. Over the long term, you've heard this in testimony prior to mine, we must reach a teacher licensure solution that ensures we place effective beginning teachers in classrooms across the state. As Dr. Christopher Smith of Augsburg College testified during last week's committee hearing, we need to get rid of the one-size-fits-all approach to licensing teachers. Yes, we need to hold schools of education accountable to preparing their students, and yes, we need to have safeguards against ineffective beginning teachers in our classroom. However, my experience as a beginning teacher myself, not too long ago, and working with hundreds of beginning teachers over the last several years, has taught me that we already have far too many unnecessary barriers that keep talented people out of our classrooms. I believe we need to do a much better job of widening, not constricting, the pipeline of talented teacher candidates. Therefore, I believe things such as a performance assessment approach, along with practitioner reflection and growth, will get us closer to this goal. While both bills fail to accomplish the right balance of accountability and flexibility, in our opinion, MNCAN stands ready to work with both authors, this committee, Board of Teaching, and Mr. Chair, you as well, to develop creative approaches to increasing the quality of teacher preparation programs, ensuring that Minnesota's teacher licensure requirements are predictive of success in our classrooms.
Thank you, Mr. Sellers, and I hope that we all take you up on your offer. members, as you recall, we laid these bills over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill, which means that they'll be coming off the table as we move toward constructing that policy bill. And so we're going to continue the discussion specifically on the bills, which means that we'll continue to invite public testimony to comment as we prepare to vote on these bills or any other bills related to this issue. At this point, what I'd like to do is use our remaining time to get into some of the – we're not going to be able to cover all the members' questions. And Representative Sawatsky, I'll start with you if your question is still something you want to ask, and it could be asked of any of our prior testifiers. Representative Sawatsky.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and members. More questions are coming up as we're going along, and I appreciate having more speakers and come to the table. But recently, one of the last things somebody just said, that the board members was exclusively teachers and hire something about hires. I thought I heard Representative Erickson say that it had board members and other people there. So it's not exclusively teachers?
That's probably, Ms. Palmer, perhaps if you can share information
and if we don't,
about
we don't necessarily need an answer, but that's a question that I have that I just want to
I'd like an answer to that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to know who the Board of Teaching is.
And I could find it, but I need this here first.
Ms. Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sawatsky, maybe can you clarify your question for me? Is it the composition of the Board of Teaching itself or the people that the Board of Teaching engaged in the development work?
I'm not sure. I just thought I heard that the Board of Teachers or the Board of Teaching was made up of exclusively teachers and something else higher ed teachers or something, but I thought I heard Representative Erickson say it was also on that board that was on MDE or on the teaching. Whatever.
Ms. Palmer, who's on the Board of Teaching? And and how is that, how are the members appointed? Are there requirements for certain slots, et cetera?
Mr. Chair, the Board of Teaching is clearly defined in terms of our Constitution in Chapter 122A. That statute provides that there are 11 members of the Board of Teaching, all governor appointees. They serve four-year terms. The composition is specifically 6 of the 11 must be current licensed practicing teachers. We do have a provision if a teacher retires, they may complete the term. So most are practicing at the time. One higher education representative, one school administrator, and 3 public members, 2 of whom must be current or former school board members.
Great.
Thank you.
And then a follow-up.
Yes, Representative Sawatsky.
As I'm online right now, so I can get the 10 examples, 10 or 12 examples of the a reading test, the math test, or the writing test. So that's it. It's finite. It's just 12 questions from what I can tell. So I invite everybody to look at that. That's quite interesting for the different levels of math that you need to know. So this is an interesting piece. My question that I'm also very concerned about is it says for the writing test that the people that are taking the test are looked at the grammar, the syntax, structure, and spelling. I'm curious, can I bring in can I use my iPad for spell check or any kind of device or a book dictionary, paper, old-fashioned Webster dictionary into the test?
And Ms. Palmer, if you can probably also kind of along with that answer, along with that question, give us an indication of what kind of accommodations are made. We heard testimony from a candidate last week who apparently has a particular form of a learning disability. So what kind of accommodations then are available? So both Representative Swatsky's question and that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swatsky, a couple things. In general, there are some test fields that do have some things available to all candidates, and then I'll hit accommodations for candidates who may have learning disabilities or other special needs in just a moment. But in general, for all candidates, the basic skills, no, there's no dictionary allowed. In fact, paper, they cannot bring paper and pencil in. There are some tests that where a calculator, an online calculator, is available, and you should be able to see that. There's a tutorial on the MTLE site, so you can see that. For example, the physics, it's the TI-30 scientific calculator that pops up, and they use that online. And so there are some fields that have those helps. There, like you said, with basic skills, mathematics, there are some fields that have a formulas and constants page, and that is available to them both before and during the test. So those kinds of things are readily available to all candidates. Now, for candidates who have specific learning needs or disabilities, there are a host of accommodations that can be provided, things like time and a half, double time, separate room, a reader, a screen reader. It just depends on the disability. It depends on the accommodation requested. There is documentation and verification required, and a recency for some conditions. For example, the documentation must be within the last 5 years. For example, if a candidate was diagnosed with a learning disability in grade school, you know, there would need to be some recency of verification of the disability and the subsequent accommodations needed, and there is room to improve on those processes. I would agree, and I think we've learned as candidates have gone through this process, and we've learned how to strengthen the processes and how to better accommodate our learners. So that it doesn't feel like a gotcha based on a disability or some other condition. But there are a host of different accommodations and many more than what I just.
Ms. Palmer, are those accommodations set out by our testing contractor, or is that something that the Board of Teaching itself makes independent? Obviously, you know, a test should be aligned to potential accommodations. That's a deeper conversation, but. Who makes that call? Is it the Board of Teaching, or is it the Board of Teaching followed by Pearson's, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be naming companies, the company's directives?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. The testing company does operationalize all of that. They have provided to us all the protocols, and we have agreed to those. And so there's an appeal process when a candidate believes that they have an accommodation should have been provided and wasn't, for example. And so there are places in the process where in a that type of a situation when the Board of Teaching would get involved in terms of whether an accommodation should be granted or not, but in general, most of these are the operational duties of the contracted company.
Members, we are out of time. I do want to finish this on time. We've all had a very rough night last night, and I think we should continue to push on. This conversation is to be continued. I know a number of you are working on legislation, and I anxiously await that series of work to continue to come forward. Members, we'll stand adjourned until our Thursday meeting at 10 o'clock.